our exploration of differential geometry and gravity and related things. So a few of you just entered. I asked if there were any questions to the rest of the group, so I will ask those who just entered. Are there any questions from last time? I do have an answer for a question from last time. Any other questions? So yesterday we talked about special relativity. We talked about how to think about space and time a la Newton and a la Einstein. And in today's tutorial, you are going to test your skills at solving special relativity problems. So if any questions come up today, anything you want me to review tomorrow, I'm happy to do that. So the other thing we started to talk about were vectors and tensors. Okay. So in answer to a question I got yesterday, which was actually said something wrong, so I will correct myself. So we talked about the concept of tangent spaces, right? So if abstractly I think about space, and I draw a plane that's tangent to this space at some point, and I think about all of the possible vectors that I could draw emanating from that point, that was something called a tangent space. Okay. So if I consider the collection of all tangent spaces, I told you yesterday that that is an example of a vector field, which I think is actually technically a little bit wrong. So the collection of all tangent spaces actually has a name of its own. It's called a tangent bundle. So that would be the collection of all vectors tangent to every point in this abstract space. By the way, these spaces have a name. They're called manifolds. I won't have time to get into the technical definition of a manifold, but for all intents and purposes, you can think of very simple examples such as the mug sitting on the table there, right? So if the mug was all that there was, the surface of the mug would be a manifold, okay? And that would be a manifold with a hole in it. So it has some topological properties that would be different from a sphere, which doesn't have a hole in it. So you'll probably learn more about manifolds in your various other courses.
So manifolds might be, I mean, they're not abstract. I mean, they can be real.
Yeah.
And the tangent spaces are the abstract spaces.
Yeah, that's kind of abstract, right? The thing that's real, though, because we know they exist, are vector fields. So let's clarify what a vector field really is. So we learned that a tangent space, right? A tangent space is an example of a vector space. Because it satisfied these properties of linearity and it had a zero vector and so on and so forth. So a vector field, if I imagine this manifold, would be like picking a set of points. Let's say this set of points here. We know that associated with each of these points, there is a tangent space. And so at each point in space, I pick one of the vectors from my tangent space, like so. That would be a vector field. Okay, so you can see that it's kind of a subset of the space of all, the subset of the tangent bundle, right? It's a subset of all the tangent spaces. So it wasn't quite technically correct to call the collection of all tangent spaces a vector field. Okay? So that would be an incarnation of a vector field. Yeah?
So you choose for every point your manifold, one vector?
Yeah, that's right. So it would be like the electric field, right? So for the electric field, we take all space, and at each point in space, we pick one member of the tangent space at that point, and then that's the value of the electric field at that point, right? It has both a magnitude and a direction.
Okay.
Yep.
So two questions. Firstly, this means that every vector field has to have the same dimension as the underlying manifold.
Correct.
And secondly, is there some restriction like continuity of a vector field? So
yeah, that's a good question. Not on its face. I could have a vector field that isn't continuous in all the derivatives along a path or something like that, and I think that's still a kosher vector field. So an example of a vector field would be one member of TP at all T. Okay, so that clarifies that.
How do you choose a particular member of T?
So that you need a rule. So you need something like Maxwell's equations or a set of equations that tell you how the vector fields are connected at each point in space. Okay. So to lead into what we're going to talk about now, so we kind of ended last time talking about vectors. So vectors were geometrical objects, coordinate. So these were coordinate independent geometrical objects, and we define vectors, as you're used to, as something which has a set of components and a set of basis elements, right? And to change coordinates, to preserve this property of being coordinate invariant, we had these general coordinate transformations, which were implemented by, say, operating on the position for vector with this, usually we put the prime there, with this linear operator lambda. And you'll recall that this could be the Lorentz transformations, or more generally, it could be a general coordinate transformation, which is given by that. Okay, so just the matrix of all partial derivatives of one coordinate system with respect to the other. So that's a general coordinate transformation. And to preserve this property, that everything is geometrical. We needed the components to transform. So if I have components which transform according to these linear operations, like so, then I have to require that my basis elements transform according to the inverse. Okay, where the inverse here was just defined by lambda mu nu prime lambda nu prime rho is delta mu rho. Okay. Question.
Why are you putting the dashes on the indices rather than the
notation? It's just this is the notation that my random choice of reference, which in this case is probably looking in the Schutz book, use. So if I put a prime on the coordinates, that's going to be equivalent to putting a prime on the actual thing. I'll just save the redundancy of putting two primes.
Because, I mean, I almost want to say that you should be changing the coordinates, not the indices, but then you're saying that you don't change the underlying vector. So is that what you're trying to...
So I could write this as follows. So A, it's a geometrical quantity, but it is a function of coordinates, right? Mm. So it's defined on some manifold, which I can lay down some coordinates on. So it could be a function of some set of coordinates. And what we're saying is that this thing doesn't really care what coordinate system I use. However, the components and the basis vectors do. But they care about it in just such a way that that dependence really just sort of canceled out. Yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, very good. Okay, so these were vectors, right? So we can define an object that is related to vectors, called dual vectors. These are the vector doppelgangers. So dual vectors, these are also called one-forms. And a dual vector is basically going to be something that acts on a vector to give me a scalar. So just like we had a vector space, we can define a dual vector space. And the dual vector space is basically going to be all linear maps from a vector space to the real numbers. Okay, so for example, if I have a dual vector space omega, then that will act on some arbitrary linear combination of real numbers times vectors, as long as it's linear, such that the dual vector doesn't really care about the scalar part, so that I can pull out front, and such that it acts linearly, or we can just distribute this, so that omega acts on V and W, okay? And this thing has to be a real number. So this is the definition of the dual vector space. So you can see it also has these sort of linearity properties, and it doesn't really care about these scalar quantities. So now we can, again, define omega as something that's going to have a set of components and a basis vector. So in this case, we're going to have components and a dual basis, set of dual basis vectors. We'll call those theta. And you'll notice the difference with vectors is just that now the index for the components is downstairs, and the index for the basis vectors is upstairs. And that's what we mean by the dual vector. Okay, so I flip things. Okay, so the components of a vector are just numbers, right? They're part of the real numbers. The components of the dual vector are also real numbers. So the work to do in order to really define the dual vector is to determine how the basis vectors operate on each other. So both the vector and the dual vector basis elements. And so we will make a definition. Okay. So we will define these dual basis elements to act on the vector basis elements so that they just give me a delta function. So when I have parentheses here, I mean, this is really it's like a function, okay? So this function is acting on something.
And that's that then changes under a coordinate transform.
That's right, yeah. That will change in different sets of coordinates, absolutely. Okay, but no matter what coordinates I work in, it's still true that I will get a delta function. So now if I use that definition, and let's say I have some dual vector and a vector, we'll call that row. Then if I act omega on V, really what I mean is take omega mu V rho, and now I want to act the dual vector basis element mu on E rho. And this thing here, according to my definition, just gives me a delta function. So I have omega mu V rho, and then delta mu rho. So now I can apply that delta function and change that rho into a mu, and I just get omega mu V mu. Okay, and by the summation notation, that just means I sum all the components of omega times the corresponding components of V. So I'd get, for example, and so on and so forth. Okay, and this is just a set of real numbers multiplied together, so indeed I get a real number. Okay, so these are dual vectors. Now, just like vectors, a dual vector is a geometrical quantity, and a dual vector acting on a vector is also just kind of a geometrical quantity. So both dual vectors and this operation here should give me something that's totally coordinate invariant. And again, I can guarantee that by specifying the transformation properties of my dual vector components and my dual vector one forms. And so you can guess that the way to do that is to make sure that the dual vector components act with the inverse of the coordinate transformation, and the dual vector basis elements act with the coordinate transformation matrix, right? So we just flip everything up there. So if we had some dual vector with elements omega mu prime, then this would just be, for example, lambda nu mu prime omega nu. And if I had some basis element theta mu prime, then that would be, why did I put that downstairs? Mu prime mu theta mu. And so now you could check that when I sandwich these two things together, here I have a coordinate, the inverse of the coordinate transformation. Here I have the coordinate transformation matrix, and then that just gives me identity, right? So you can show for yourself, really short exercise, that with these definitions, the product of a dual vector acting on a vector gives me something that's coordinate invariant. Okay. So that's coordinate invariant. That also means it's Lorentz invariant. Okay, so if I have dual vector acting on a vector, that's a Lorentz invariant. So any dual vector acting on a vector is also a Lorentz invariant. It's a coordinate invariant, it's a Lorentz invariant, those are the same thing. Okay, so that's dual vectors. Any questions about dual vectors? Okay, so now we just smash everything together. We smash vectors together and dual vectors together. And an arbitrary smashing of vectors and dual vectors is a tensor. So a tensor is basically a, again, I guess this is multilinear map from collections of vectors and dual vectors to real numbers. And as you might guess, just based on what we did here with vectors and dual vectors, the way to make real numbers is to soak up the indices. So whenever I have a downstairs index, I multiply by an upstairs index. Okay. So tensors have, we'll just maybe write that down. So let's say I had a tensor operating on a vector and a one form. Okay. You might guess before we do anything that if I have some set of a vector and a one form, I need to soak up the indices. So this would be mu downstairs and rho upstairs, for example. Okay. So that would be a real number, because now I just have a set of components that I'm summing over. OK, that's an example. Now we'll go into the details. So tensors have a rank. Okay, so usually we call tensors rank k, L, where k is the number of dual vectors that you act on, and L is the number of vectors that you act on. So a quick example. A scalar would be a 0,0 tensor. It's something I actually don't multiply any vector or dual vector by. That's a boring one. So what rank would a vector be? 1,0. And what rank would a dual vector be? 0,1. And this example I gave here would be 1,1. Yeah.
And according to the definition of a tensor, that omega v that we multiply there, that's also a tensor.
So omega acting on V is also a tensor. It would be a scalar. So that would be a rank 0,0 tensor. That's right. Everything is a tensor, right? Any number is a tensor. OK, great. So that's a tensor. So we need to define the tensor in a geometrical way. And I've already kind of hinted at how this works. It has to do with basically some set of components and some basis vectors. So, for example, this,
question. 2 seconds. I just want to check. The dual vectors are one forms. There's no difference between them. They're just one forms.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so, for example, this, this thing I gave here. So it's got some set of components, and the basis elements are just going to be either the vector basis elements or the dual vector basis elements. But they come in a direct tensor product. Okay. So in this case, we would have e hat, theta hat mu e hat rho. And they're mushed together with a direct tensor product. So remember that these things are operators. So here comes the question of ordering again. So the ordering very much matters. If I flip the order in the tensor product, I get something that's fundamentally different. In that case, I would get something that would be t rho mu. And now it would be e hat. Rho mu. e rho, direct product theta mu. Okay. So the ordering of the indices reflects the ordering in the tensor product. Okay, and that's just, this will be our convention. I think everyone uses this convention. And so this is why the ordering of the indices fundamentally matters. OK, Questions on tensors? Okay, let me give you a few quick examples. Sorry, question?
To switch the ordering, you can use the metric, right?
Yeah, so you'd have to do an operation with the metric tensor, which
right.
would involve actually doing some operations, right?
Okay.
It would be some operator you're acting with. But we will talk about the metric tensor in just 1 minute, and we'll talk about also it does. Okay. So just a few quick examples to keep in your head. Okay, a vector, that's an easy one. I don't know, 1 y hat plus 2 x hat, right? So a 3 vector, that's a great example of a vector. So you already know all about vectors. Example of a dual vector. So who goes mountain climbing in this room? Okay, excellent. We've got some climbers. So you've seen topographical maps. Yeah, so your route up the mountain would be a great example of a dual vector. So I take some topographical map of some peak. And if a climber wants to minimize his trip up the mountain, then he wants to go probably along the gradient of that topographical map. And if I denote the height of the mountain as a function h, then I can define the sort of directional derivative of the mountain, right? And that's a great example of a one form. So a great example of a tensor, which will lead me into the next topic of conversation, would be eta, right? The line element. So that would be a rank what tensor?
0.
Yeah, so I act on 2 vectors in order to get a scalar. That's right. Okay, so we have the line element. That's a great example of a tensor. So for example, if I act on 2 copies of the momentum, then that was eta mu nu, p mu, p nu, which we saw in the last lecture as just the rest mass. Okay. So that's an example of a 2-0 tensor, excuse me. No, wrong. It's
zero.
A 0-2 tensor.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Okay, so keep these examples in mind and you'll never forget what these things mean. Okay, so another way that you'll see tensors defined are in terms of their transformation properties. We've already kind of seen that. Okay, so if I have some arbitrary, we'll do a more complicated example. Let's say I have a rank 2-2 tensor, looks something like this. Then in order to transform coordinates, the transformation law, basically I just paste together a set of these partial derivatives of coordinates in order to soak up all the indices. Did you have a question?
Yeah, just again, to make sure I understand the question. That would be a 2-vector that acts on vectors?
Yeah, so the lower indices mean it acts on vectors. That's right. So I need to act on 2 vectors to get a scalar quantity.
You just switch the definition of which number goes first? Go up, isn't it?
Did I? Yeah, it was just
there
because
you go,
the
vector is 1-0.
Yeah, so a vector needs to act on a dual vector to get a scalar. That's why it was 1-0.
Okay.
a dual vector has to act on a vector to get a scalar. That's why it's 0, 1. And if I had two lower indices, then that would have to act on two vectors, which would make it a 0, 2. Thanks. OK. So tensors, in some contexts, you can define them, in fact, just by their transformation properties. So we'll just write out a string of partial derivatives with the appropriate indices on top or on bottom to soak up these guys. And then over here, I'll have mu, nu, rho, sigma. So I need to soak up those indices, dx mu, dx nu, dx rho, dx sigma. Okay, so if I have an object with indices, then this, in a sense, can define the tensor for you, where now the rank would just count how many primed indices do I have upstairs and downstairs. Okay, that's another way to define it.
And you can't just transform the single index this way. You've got to do all of them because there's also going to be some basis.
Yeah, if I didn't do all of them, then remember the basis vectors transform, so the geometrical quantity would then be a coordinate dependent object, and it shouldn't be. Okay. So with that small aside, let's return to the metric, which is probably the most useful tensor in the world. So we should know a lot about what the metric does. It's actually probably one of the most useful mathematical objects, I would say, in the world. It has so many jobs. So what does the metric do? So metric, job, description. So number one, so sort of by definition, because if I act on two vectors, I get a scalar quantity. The metric determines the inner product or the generalization of the dot product. Okay, so if I act eta on a vector and another vector, then I get, and that's kind of like the generalization of V dot W. Okay, if we were talking about flat three-dimensional space, then that would just be V dot W. It's just the dot product. Okay, that's metric job number one. In the same sense, the metric defines orthogonality, right? So if I take eta acting on V and W and I get 0, that means it's orthogonal. Raise that up. See? Just in the same sense that if the dot product between two vectors is 0, we say that they're orthogonal. More generally, it defines a norm. Three. So we talked about this yesterday when we drew our picture. So if I have eta mu nu, v mu, v nu, then if this quantity is less than 0, we say that v mu is time-like. If it equals 0, we say that v mu is null. And if it's less than 0, I think I got that wrong. Less than 0, greater than 0, we call v mu space-like. OK, so the norm defines, what's that? Sometimes when you look at the board, we get really confused by the simplest things. OK, indeed, that is what I meant. If I get a negative number, it's time-like. If I get a positive number, it's space-like. Question.
Now, when we talk, when I've talked about norms previously on norm spaces, then you can't have, they've got to be positive definite. So this is a generalization of some kind.
Yeah, so now the magic comes about because at least for flat space, we had a minus sign. So now I can get varying sign depending on which direction the vector is pointing in. And so, go ahead, did you want to follow up?
So this doesn't satisfy the triangle inequality or anything like that?
Nope.
Nope. Okay.
So it's now you generalize that. So in general, while I have that here, so this this metric has a signature. So if I compute the determinant of this metric, I'll get -1, right? And in general, if the determinant is negative, then we say this has Lorentzian signature. Okay. Why does our metric have Lorentzian signature? Great question. Somehow time is really different than space. And if you figure out why, you'll probably get the Nobel Prize. So anyway, in our universe anyway, it has Lorentzian signature. You will often, if you are aspiring string theorists, play with that and look at Euclidean signatures. If it's a if det metric is equal, it, well, basically is bigger than 0, then we call that Euclidean. You might be interested in that for math reasons, but it also turns out that if you study physics at finite temperature, that's often well described by a metric that has Euclidean signature as opposed to Lorentzian signature. If you study quantum mechanics, oftentimes it's helpful to think in terms of a Euclidean signature. Yeah.
This is a really petty point, I feel, but when you've written up the definition of the norm for like time-like norm and space-like,
yep.
Should you write V mu being time-like, or should you write V being time-like because it's like a property of a geometric object rather than its coordinates?
That's a good point. So V is, I could write either.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I could write either is because there's no coordinate transformation that I can do which is going to take me from being space-like to null. Or you know, anything else. And the reason is that this is a scalar quantity.
Yep.
So that's really a coordinate invariant.
Yep.
So any way you like it, either would be fine.
Earlier, actually, when I studied something like this, I studied covariant and contravariant vectors. So
yeah.
They are equivalent to the vector and the dual vector.
Correct. Yeah, that's just a different terminology. This is probably a slight generalization of those ideas. Because now we're talking about covariant and contravariant vectors wouldn't get me two tensors. So I just have to generalize that a little bit. Yeah. Have a question?
Yeah, it's also a definition, but do you define, for example, a 2 minuses and 2 plus 1 as a Euclidean
signature? I guess so, but we never really, that'd be a really weird one, because it'd be like there's two time-like directions. Yeah, I don't know what that means. It's, typically, you'll have one minus sign or all positive signs, or if you're a particle physicist and you're a very negative person, you'd have one minus minus minus.
Yeah.
But anyway, you cut it. The in this case, the determinant would always be -1, and that's the important part.
So then, in this case, will you change the call the Euclidean signature, then
determine
eta would be less than.
So it's Euclidean if it's positive. It's Lorentzian if it's negative.
No, I mean you are here just changing the metric, right? And this is just a different convention.
Yeah, it's just a different convention, but that's still a Lorentzian metric because the determinant is still minus one.
Are you trying to say that when you if you were to take off the top of the time-like component of that, then you still have a negative determinant?
Oh, I see. Yeah. That only really makes sense, I guess, if you.
So this is why particle physicists are wrong. Right?
Yeah. There you go. Awesome. I like it. Go tell all your friends. Make a T-shirt. Yeah, I guess there.
But this doesn't make sense if you, I mean, that's just a convention. Why should we call it the Lorentzian signature still machine? I mean, we should change the definition of that.
Good luck making that argument.
Negative scalar curvature, for instance.
What's that?
That would give you, like, if you did the same, had the same signature for like a metric on a sphere, it would give you negative scalar curvature, which is weird.
Yeah, but particle physicists don't usually like to work in curved space, so it's always flat space. And when it's always flat space,
so
it doesn't matter.
Want,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you're all aspiring relativists or cosmologists, of course. So you always use that signature. And you'll never have to worry about it. Okay, so it defines a norm for us. The metric's other job description is that it also raises and lowers indices. Okay, so there's the metric, and there's also the inverse metric. Okay, so the inverse metric. We define just as the delta function. So here we need rho and mu to be the same, and we need nu and sigma to be the same. Cool. So we define the inverse metric. That's the inverse metric. As such. So if I want to make a vector from a one form, for example, I can just act with the inverse matrix, with the inverse metric. Okay, so you can see that this just takes the lower index nu and it turns it into an upper index mu. Question.
So this implies that your metric's got to be invertible.
Yep.
Is there any other restrictions on it?
No, I don't think so.
Symmetric.
It's a well-defined inverse. Okay, so the metric raises and lowers indices. It can raise and lower as many indices as you want by multiplying by the metric as many times as you want with the appropriate sets of indices. Okay. So it can also raise and lower indices on tensors, on vectors, on anything you want. Okay, so while we're on the metric, I have a few more things to say about that. So from a day-to-day perspective, those are the jobs of the metric. Okay, it does these things for us. It does much more, in fact, and we will talk at great length over the next however much time I have in this lecture and next lecture about how to interpret the metric. And how to generalize it, how to think about it. Okay, so when we're talking about a general metric, we have eta over there, and eta is sort of typically taken to mean this metric in particular. Okay, so -1, 1, 1, 1.
I have another silly question. So when we are lowering the index on a dual vector, what does it usually mean? Vectors have lower indices according to our convention.
Uh-huh.
And there,
vectors have upper indices according to convention. Dual vectors have the lower indices.
Oh, sorry.
Yep.
Okay, so what does it mean if it has an upper index?
Now it's a vector. So the metric is a map from dual vectors to vectors. Really, any 0, 2 tensor, if I act on one dual vector, or one vector, excuse me, would give me a dual vector, right? So it's really convention and physics that tells me that the metric is the right 0-2 tensor that operates on these objects to give me a map. There are an infinite number of maps I can imagine. It's just that this is the physically relevant map. And that's physics, that's not math. Okay, so in general, when I want to talk about stuff that's not just the metric on Minkowski space, the flat metric with a minus sign and the time component, we usually write g mu nu, little g mu. So everything I said over here applies equally well to eta or g. Same thing. In general, we can actually identify what these basis elements are. Okay, so the general definition of the vector basis element is in fact just the partial derivative operator. That is the basis element. That's the right operator that has the right properties to do what you want. And the right operator that has the right properties to do what you want for the dual basis element is something like the gradient of a coordinate. Okay? So in general, we make these definitions. Okay? And so now we can go back to the line element. Okay? So we had before delta S squared equals eta mu nu delta x mu delta x nu. And we can promote this to tensorial notation so that we know we're talking about an honest-to-God tensor. So the first thing we're going to do is we're just going to change the symbol we mean by delta. That's easy. Okay, but this is still a scalar number. And we know now we have, we want to make a geometrical quantity. Sorry, I said that was a scalar number. That's actually wrong. The line element, this is like a scalar. Said it again. This is like a geometrical quantity. Okay. So to make a geometrical quantity, we want to make a tensor which has elements and or components and basis elements. Okay, and the appropriate, in this case, basis elements, because this is a 0-2 tensor, are these gradients of coordinates, right? So this is what we mean by the metric in a fully tensorial way. Okay, so the line element is this geometrical quantity. It's really a 0-2 tensor. Okay, it has components that are given by g mu nu, and the basis elements are just these dx mu dx nu. Now we never write it like this. Okay, and we're always very sloppy with the definitions. So the mathematicians in the room will cringe and they will hate this, but that's you will never get into trouble doing this. So typically we get rid of that tensor product. Okay, so we are all physicists. And physicists will just disregard the tensorial meaning of this equation and write it as ds squared equals g mu nu dx mu dx nu, and do really nasty things like I will show you right now. Okay, so let's say I have a null path. Okay. So for a null path, we knew that delta s was 0 from before. So we're just going to say that means that ds is 0. Okay. And now let's say I have the simplest metric, which is just Minkowski space. And let's say I had a null path in the x direction to make our lives just a little bit easier. So if I wrote out the metric, then I just take the negative 1, which would be the time component. And then I just take dt times dt, and I call it dt squared. Okay, and then I have the other piece, which would be dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And that would be my shorthand for this tensor. Okay. So I told you we're considering a null path. So we're going to set that to 0. And we're going in the x direction. And if we're going in the x direction, that would mean that delta x squared was 0 and delta y squared was 0. So we're just going to say that that means ds squared is 0 and dy squared is 0. So we get rid of those.
Delta z squared.
Yeah, thanks. Y, z, thank you very much. Y and z. So we're just going to set those to 0. And now I have this equation, which would be 0 is negative dt squared plus dx squared. So, okay, I can solve for dx squared equals dt squared. And now I'll just take the square root, and I'll get rid of that square, dx dt. And now I'm going to sandwich one on top of the other, and I'll say that this is, well, let's put a plus minus there, because we should be careful. And I'll say that dx dt is equal to plus or minus 1. Okay. I've also done something here, which I guess I hadn't assumed yet. There should be a c squared in here. So this is plus or minus c. Plus or minus c dt. And I can solve this differential equation and figure out how light travels in flat space. And lo and behold, I find that x equals ct plus or minus ct plus a constant. Okay, and that's how we roll as physicists. We develop all this machinery to define these tensors and all this and that, and then we throw it all out the window. And we just manipulate this equation like crap, right? I mean, this is totally, the way we do it is very fast and loose. I assure you that if I were a mathematician, I could probably spend a few hours and justify this. Okay. But anyway, that's what we do. So you can do that. You have permission. You totally have permission.
How can you make sense of the tensor product normally if you've got like dx nu tensor dx nu?
How do you mean?
How do you like, I mean, you know, because that's the thing, is if you've thrown out the tensorial structure.
Right.
Like, how would you deal with that if you're not prepared to throw it away?
So then you just have to be really careful and define how that as an operator acts on other objects. So for example, if you wanted to be super careful and define how dx mu acts on partial nu. You'd have to know that that was a delta function, and you'd multiply everything out, and you'd keep track of all the delta functions, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of the day, you'd get the same answer as if you just threw all that out the window and just operated using, you know, sort of like the naive definition of what these symbols mean. Yeah.
Could you go maybe into a little bit more detail about what you mean in the left of the second board here, where e mu is partial derivative and theta nu is, you said that was the derivative, the differential, or it looks like a differential, but it's not, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of, this you can think, the dual basis vector. It's, you can almost think of it as a symbol. I mean, it's kind of related to the gradient of the coordinate function, but you can almost just throw that out and say it's a symbol. And it's a symbol defined such that when I act dx mu on partial mu, partial nu, I get the delta function. So that would be delta mu nu. Now, I can also think of it a different way, which manifests the fact that this is like a gradient of the coordinate operator. If I just realize that that's something that would give me the delta function. So in a sense...
In flat space.
In general, actually. That's totally general.
Yeah, you have to have local
local.
Yeah.
Local what?
Like your basis vector. Oh,
yeah, yeah. In, right.
So...
Because you don't always...
Oh, okay.
Well, well, this is just think more naively, right? Like,
sure.
This is just, I have t, x, y, z.
Sure, yeah.
If I take the derivative of t with respect to z, that's zero,
right.
Just by definition.
Right.
Okay. So this, in a sense, defines what I mean by that symbol. Okay, and you can see it's kind of like the coordinate x. Yeah.
And is there any, I mean, you can still contract these operators with your metric, right?
I can still contract operators with my metric. What
like,
do you mean?
Because you're defining these things as operators now, but if you
right.
put a met, like you could say that E mu is equal to eta mu nu theta mu, is that correct?
Let me write what it means, I'm having trouble. So
sorry. I said E hat mu.
Yeah.
Subscript, sorry. is equal to eta subscript mu nu.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Theta sub.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
No, that's not quite right. Because you're using the metric components to act on these dual basis vectors. So that as an operation would not do naively what you think it does.
Okay.
So what you would need to do that more carefully, would be to define instead a vector v and have the metric act on the vector v. And then that the piece in here, so here we have eta mu nu v nu. And then I'd have in here the theta hat mu, and then I'd have theta hat nu operating on E nu. Okay, and then that would give me the delta function. Well, in this case, it's trivial, I guess. Maybe I should have used some dummy indices to make it more clear. And then that's the piece that operates, right? So it's really just the basis elements operate on other basis elements. Components don't do that. And then I get an object which is now a one form because I've lowered the index, and you can see it comes with a one form basis element. Okay, any other questions? All right, so that kind of leads us to the end of this exposition about tensors and their definition and how to use them. So now we're going to move on to applications, namely gravity. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is a little explanation of why it is that gravity has anything to do with geometry. So you've heard this, but why? Yeah, question.
Sorry, just going back to that.
No problem.
Omar, I think you've got four U's there in the one line.
Yeah, so here's what I should have done.
Sorry.
No, it's no problem. So what I should have done is, let's call that rho.
Yep.
That's a dummy index. And let's call this sigma.
Yep.
So in fact, I shouldn't have that. I should have rho correspond to rho,
yep.
And sigma correspond to sigma there.
Yep.
And then I'll get a delta function in there. And you should never be as sloppy as I am with dummy indices, ever. Bad. Do what I say, don't do what I do. Here's my eraser. Okay, so I'll start this. I won't finish. So let's talk about gravity and geometry. So again, we'll go back to Newton. So if I have an object of mass m, I think we all know that if I look at some object which is at some position described by the position vector r, and that object has some mass, we'll call it mg, that Newton tells us the force on this particle is going to be Newton's constant times mg times big M over the magnitude of r squared in the r direction. Right? So, okay, that's the force on this particle. And Newton also tells us that F equals MA. And there is absolutely no reason whatsoever why this M that I attach to the particle that tells me the gravitational force should be equal to the M that appears in MA. No reason at all. So this is typically called the gravitational mass. And this one we'll call the inertial mass. And to give you an analogy of why they don't really have to be the same, I mean, so we know there's an electric force, right? It looks a lot like this, and it's got some other constant up top. Okay, we call it charge. So gravity has a charge, right? And the charge that gravity acts on is mass. Unlike electricity and magnetism, there seems to be no negative charge. So things like to come together. I guess the sign is different too. But anyways, there's a charge we associate with mass. And that doesn't have to be the same as the inertial mass. And that was the great insight of Einstein. I mean, okay, you know, you open a freshman physics book, it's taken for granted. You just take it for granted. That's the same M. But really, if you think about it and you require that always these two masses are equal, it has some very profound physical implications. Okay, so this is something known as this is an incarnation of the equivalence principle. So this would be the weak equivalence principle. And so if we want to write out a more formal definition, what the weak equivalence principle really means is that in a small enough region of space-time, the motion of freely falling particles is the same in a uniform gravitational field and a uniformly accelerating frame. Okay, so here in this room, I can't tell the difference between sitting on Earth with gravitational acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared, or sitting in a box in the middle of outer space accelerating at 9.8 meters per second squared. Of course, if I went into outer space, I could feel that, because I could move around and I could see, oh, the Earth is this spherical object, and if I move in different places, I actually see a different gravitational field. Or even if I climb Mount Everest, and I had a really precise accelerometer, I would see that, the gravitational force on top of Mount Everest is a little bit different than it is here, because Mount Everest weighs a lot. So that's the weak equivalence principles. There are other incarnations of the equivalence principle. So there's the strong equivalence principle, which says something like, you know, even gravity gravitates. So everything everything should act this way. And that is a very profound statement. And it really just follows from thinking about this equality. Okay?
Sorry, can I just check?
Yep.
You've got the motion of free-forming particles is the same in a uniformly gravitational field as it is in a uniformly accelerating frame.
Right.
Okay.
The reason is because if that were the uniform gravitational field, I'd have mg times the acceleration, gravitational acceleration. Here I have mi times a,
yeah.
And I'm just saying that the force in both cases would be identical, right? I just have m, the same constant m, times an acceleration. And there would be no way for me to distinguish if that acceleration was coming from being in a screwy frame or due to the fact that there's a big lump of Earth under my feet. I just have an equation that's m times an acceleration, and there's no other information in it. And if you like, that's kind of the mathematical statement of the equivalence principle.
So where is that not true?
So it's not true if I can see tidal forces, or if I can see deviations in my little box of the fact that if I move to the right-hand side, I feel a little bit more acceleration than if I move to the left-hand side.
So that's only uniform acceleration.
Yeah, so then let me give you an example. Bring this back down. Okay, so let's say I have a lump of stuff and I have a big enough box, right? Now if I look at the force on, say, these three particles, it would look something like this. So that if I drop these three particles, I'd actually see that they're getting closer together. Now, if instead I had the same box, and that box was accelerating together at some acceleration a, right? Now I wouldn't see that anymore. Now the force on these blobs, in this case I guess it would look like that, would just push them all in the same direction. So if I did this experiment and I asked, do the particles get closer together or not in my box, I'd be able to tell if I was sitting outside of a spherical lump of stuff or if I was sitting in a box inside a rocket.
So would a sufficient condition be that if there's no relative acceleration, if there's uniform gravity?
Yeah.
If you find it, yeah.
Yep, that's right. So then you're either... Well, you don't know. You're either in a uniformly accelerating frame or you're in a uniform gravitational
unless
field.
There's relative acceleration.
Yeah, that's right.
So small enough means your box is sufficiently small that there's no experiment evaporators able to tell that deviation.
Exactly. So even in this case, this would hold if I made a really tiny box. That box wouldn't be able to tell the fact that it's around spherical objects. Yeah. That's also a very profound statement. I won't get into that much, but if...
It's just the same as that, though.
What's that?
You choose a small enough region, you're always...
Yeah, then there's always... you're always safe. Yeah, if you choose a small enough region, then this always holds.
At a point, it always holds.
At a point, it always holds,
yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So the profound statement is that in that tiny little box, because it's indistinguishable from a totally uniform acceleration, I can go to a frame that's accelerating with my tiny little box, and I can make it look just like flat space. So in a tiny enough box, in a tiny enough window of space-time, I can always make it look like Minkowski space. Just by going to this frame that's accelerating with the box. All right. I think I'm actually going to wait until next time to tell you about, I don't know, can I do it in 10 minutes? I can do it in 10 minutes. You guys don't mind if I keep you 5 extra minutes? Okay.
Lunch starts at 12 anyway.
Okay, so you just need to go eat. So I'm going to sketch for you the fastest way that I know to show you that gravity might have something to do with curvature. This isn't it's rigorous in the sense that it's mathematically rigorous, but it doesn't show you all the nice, beautiful math associated with the tensors and things we've talked about. This is like the rough and dirty way. Since I have 4 lectures, I want to show you Einstein's equation way to do it. So why does the equivalence principle mean that gravity has something to do with geometry? Okay, so first let's consider Newton, so I can just illustrate a simple point. We'll then talk about special relativity, and I'll show you how to promote that to general relativity in a very fast way. So let's consider a free particle. Okay, so there's no forces acting on this particle. And I know that from F equals 0, that and let's even make it simpler in one dimension, that d squared y dt squared, the acceleration is equal to 0. So according to Newton, we can transform to an accelerating frame. And the way we would accomplish that transformation is just to change coordinates. Okay, and we're just going to do x minus 1/2 at squared. Okay, so we'll just move to some accelerating trajectory. And that's going to be our frame. Okay, so we could compute dy dt. So that's going to be dx dt minus at. And we can compute second derivative. And that's going to be the second derivative of x with respect to t minus a, okay, and that we said was equal to 0. So if I want to work in this x frame, you can plainly see that there is now a force, right? So I've turned this choice of frame into what would now be a force on this particle in one dimension. Okay, so now let's repeat this exercise in special relativity and add some indices. Okay, so you know, we have the line element, which we've been talking about. And what I can do is I can actually compute here something known as the proper time. So if I pick a particular trajectory, then the proper time, which we'll call tau, just means I stick a minus sign out front. Okay, so the statement that there's no force in special relativity, well, first of all, I have to add an index. So now I'm talking about a 4 vector. Is that the second derivative with respect to the proper time of my coordinate is 0. Okay, So that's Newton's law. That's the relativistic generalization of Newton's law. Okay, so if I say that I have a free particle, then that derivative will be zero. Okay, so this is really four equations, right? Because I've got four indices. And the next thing we're going to do is the same thing. We're going to go to a frame that has uniform acceleration. But now we're going to say that, actually, no. I take that back. Let's go to an arbitrary frame. Okay, so we're just going to perform a coordinate change. So we'll have y. And we're going to go to this other coordinate system, x mu. So we can just take that equation now and use the chain rule. So we've got dy rho, let's do the first one. So dy d tau. And we can write that as dy dx mu d tau. And when I said just use the chain rule, really what I mean is this is a vector, and I can apply the transformation law for vectors, right? That's the more technically precise way of doing it. But if you're fast and loose, it's just chain rule. And I guess these should really be partial derivatives, maybe. Okay, and now we can take the second derivative. Okay, so in taking the second derivative, now I'm going to have to start taking tau derivatives of some of these functions in here. Okay, so the first one's easy. I've got partial y, partial x, dx mu. Second derivative now acting on the x mu part. And now I want to again apply the chain rule. So when I act on this set of partial derivatives, I want to multiply by a coordinate and then at the penalty of getting another tau derivative of this coordinate here. So we'll get the second derivative of y rho with respect to x mu, x nu. Now I pick up a dx nu d tau from the chain rule, dx mu d tau, that's just left over from there. Okay. And this thing is supposed to equal zero if we have a free particle. And so now I can solve for this guy here, second derivative of x mu. We'll change indices just to make it fun. Okay, so now I've got this guy. I'm going to flip it around. So what we'll really have here is dx lambda now, dy rho. And then we've got this second derivative, d squared y rho, dx mu, dx nu. And that thing is multiplying dx mu d tau dx nu d tau. Okay, so in general, you can see we get a force. So in this accelerating frame, this is the force on our particle. And you can see it's this prefactor, which has some indices. So the non-contracted indices are lambda, mu, and nu. Okay, so I have an object with three indices. And we're going to define a symbol that expresses this object. Okay? So this symbol is gamma. This is the Christoffel symbol. And with this definition, we can now ask, okay, well, I have this equation here. It's got to do with these second derivatives of my coordinate transformation. What does this have to do with geometry? So to see what this has to do with geometry, all we need to do is change coordinates in our metric. We started in the y coordinates. Okay, so here's our metric in terms of the y coordinates. And we just want to change this to the metric in terms of the x coordinates. And of course, by now you all can do this on your own. It's just a set of partial derivatives, right? So in here, what we get is now we'll soak up some of these contracted indices to make our lives a little bit more clear. Okay, so this was just negative 1, 1, 1, 1. But now these are arbitrary space-time functions. Okay. And so this quantity, we can just call it something. We'll call it the metric. Okay. So by going to this accelerating frame, we change from the normal flat space metric with just negative 1, 1, 1, 1 to this arbitrary 4 by 4 matrix. Okay, and that is the general metric tensor. So this equation here actually has a name. So this is the geodesic equation of general relativity. And you can see that if I want to define this Christoffel symbol, we're almost at the punchline. So what I can do is I can define this Christoffel symbol. And I'll leave this as a homework exercise. I actually worked it out, and I promise it actually works. You can show that with that definition of the metric that I wrote up there, we get 1 half g lambda rho times d mu g nu rho plus d nu g rho mu minus d rho g mu nu. Okay. So you can write this term that appears in the force equation as derivatives of the metric. And that means the force on the particle can be thought of as a totally geometrical effect, completely geometrical. All it has to do with is the metric, which tells me about the geometry on my space-time, and its derivatives. And that's it. So now, if I really trust the equivalence principle, then I can throw away the fact that I lived in a uniformly accelerating frame, and I can say that this applies equally well to the gravitational force. Okay, so if I believe the equivalence principle, then it says that this equation that I wrote down mu d tau dx nu d tau, then this is the equation that describes the motion of particles in a gravitational field. Oops. Excuse me. And with all drama, in fact, smash, that is the equation that governs the motion of particles in a gravitational field. Okay. So starting from the equivalence principle, doing some simple coordinate transformations in special relativity can give you this, okay, where the main assumption was that the equivalence principle holds. Okay. And that's the simplest way I know of to show you how gravity has something to do with geometry. Okay, so the force on a particle actually can be described in a purely geometrical way. Excellent. So tomorrow, I will tell you about the Einstein equation, because we understand everything that we need to know to understand the Einstein equation. Before you run off for lunch, is there any questions? Yep.
So for your Christoffel symbol, what's the order of indices, like left and right?
So this is the one exception to my rule. So the Christoffel symbol, actually, it doesn't matter. You put one on top of the other. What's that?
It's not a tensor.
It's not a tensor. Indeed. Yeah. It's just a thing with indices, symbol with indices.
But only the bottom two are anti-symmetric, so it would still be better to sort of shift those two. Because if you lower the other one with the metric, they might get confused, because only those two are anti-symmetric.
You cannot lower indices on the Christoffel symbol. So, in fact, there is no context where you will get confused, because it's not a tensor, so it doesn't make sense to try and turn it into a tensor. Yep. Very good. Okay, see you tomorrow.